Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Are we doing this?
Really?
Wait for it.
Are we doing this?
Wait for it.
Pow!
What the fuck?
WTF.
And it's also, what the fuck?
What's wrong with me? It's time for WTF.
What the fuck?
With Mark Maron.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckables? What the fuck sticks? What the fuckadelics? What the fuckleberry fins? That's enough of that. I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Thank you for joining me. I seem to be in a chronic brain skid. I don't know if I have PTSD from everything that's led up to this moment or what. I'm here. I'm in the present, but things just, I don't seem to stop. I just seem to keep doing and doing and putting things in and doing and putting things into my head. There's this moment where, and it doesn't help, as I said before, that there's no seasonal shift here in LA, and everything's just becoming a smear on the calendar. My brain is becoming just a consciousness smear, just a smear of a life. That's what's happening. My brain is smearing life. Right now, it's smearing. I didn't even realize how much I enjoyed the word smear. Today on the show, Chris Parnell from 30 Rock, from SNL, from television and movies. You know who he is. Come on. We had a nice chat. What's going on? Where are we at? I went running today. I did not run in the 100-degree heat or the 90-degree heat or whatever the fuck it is today on October 2nd. I got to get back to New York, man. I got to get into that fall, man. Fall just breaks open my brain. Fall is my time. Fall is when I can layer. I enjoy layering. I enjoy wearing a corduroy blazer occasionally. I enjoy putting on a sweater, maybe an L.L. Bean flannel or chamois. That's what I enjoy. I want to put my boots on. I want to walk around all bundled up with a scarf and maybe even a little hat. What do you call those hats again? What do you call those ones that I wear sometimes? A toque? Who am I talking to? Yeah, man, maybe that's what it's called. All right, thanks. Thanks for checking in. No problem, dude. I'll be right here if you need me. All right, buddy, just keep an eye on me. I'm always keeping an eye on you. I can't control you, but, you know, I'm doing what I can here. I can only be as positive as you allow me to be. All right, it's just getting confusing. I think it's a toque. Is it a toque? I don't know, but I would like to layer. I can't wait to go back to New York for a couple days. I'm going back for this New Yorker festival next weekend. I don't even know if there are tickets available for that or how the show is going to work or what. But, I mean, as some of you, well, those are sold out, too. I'll be back in New York November 7th for a couple of shows at the Skirball Center. And then I'm going to be back. I'm doing Comics Come Home up in Boston. And I believe that's on the 8th of November after I do the shows in New York. And I'm going to hopefully it won't be snowing by then, but I'll take in a little fall. I just miss it. I miss the crisp feel of the air. I miss that weird, you know, slight chill. It's almost a romantic chill of the fall, and my brain just breaks open, and all the weird things that moved me through my entire life just come right to the surface and fall. If they don't come right up to the surface, the feeling of it does. The feeling of it. I need some fall. I'm sweating and I'm smearing and I'm getting. It's not delusional. It's just like everything is just kind of, it's hazy, man. It's hazy. So I went running today at the gym. I got to get back on that, you know, because I'm holding on to the dream here. And I know it's healthy, but it did make me feel better. You have to get into that state of mind, that weird, you know, once you start going back to the gym, you just have to, it's just crossing that line. It's just like pushing through that invisible wall and be like, all right, I'm going to do it. And the first time it's sort of like, that wasn't too bad. But then you go back again and you realize, all right, I have a brain state that occurs at the gym, and you just, you know, drift into that state. You know why you're there. There's no reason to freak out about it, and you just sort of, you know, kind of lay into it, you know, stretch it out, get on the machine, sweat it out, wipe down the machine if you're one of those people. I'm not a wiper. I'll towel it off, but I don't go get the cleaning products. I can't fucking stand when people just start spraying fucking cleaning products when you're trying to breathe. You ever been at a restaurant where they wipe down a fucking table next to you with Windex or some shit and just fuck up your nose for the whole meal? It's bullshit. Same with running, man. You're running, some guy comes and squirts a bunch of fucking industrial cleaner on the thing, like the Ebola's right there on the machine. I guess, well, maybe that's a possibility. No, I don't know. They're saying it can't spread, but these fucking bugs are pretty devious. They're gunning for the big prize. You know what I'm saying? The bugs are gunning for the big prize. They are the meek, the viral entities, the renegade strands of RNA looking to complete themselves with your cells. Those are the ones, man. Those are the ones that God left incomplete. They're gunning for the big time. So that's going to be the fight. You think ISIS is the fight? No, it's just these renegade viral strands of half the genetic material they need to survive. Oh, man. But what did I just synopsize The Stand by Stephen King? I didn't even read that book, but it's got something to do with that, right? Am I wrong? Is there a vaccine? Is there a vaccine for life? God, it's freeform riffage today. That's all that's happening. It's fall. It's fall. It is fall. Okay? I want to wear a scarf. I want to wear a hat. I want to eat some pumpkin pie. I want to feel the crispness. I want to feel it. Something about it, man. Something about the fall just shakes loose all those old first feelings. Like right now, I'm sort of excited about this. I got this book in the mail, and this is not a sponsor. This is not a plug, but it's something I'm excited. Fantagraphics Books, who just decided to start sending me books again, which I'm thrilled about, they've just come out with this. The Mythology of S. Clay Wilson, Volume 1, Pirates in the Heartland. S. Clay Wilson. Do you remember the first time you ever saw an S. Clay Wilson panel? It was almost as powerful as your first blowjob. It was almost as mind-blowing. I mean, I can look at these things now. You know, the strips are fine, but the panels, man. In the back of the book, they got the big color panels. S. Clay Wilson was just fucking beautiful filth, just mind-blowing. All these elaborate panels, they're comics, but they're full of demons and boobs and drugs and pirates and bikers and, you know, knives and cocks and pussies and more boobs. It's just like sex, violence, debauchery, the checker demon. This, oh my God, I'm just looking at it now. I don't know what age I saw this in. I can't remember if I saw it in, I think I saw it in a magazine first. I think I saw it in either, maybe it was Heavy Metal or maybe it was in National Lampoon when I was a kid. But do you remember the things that had that impression on you? I mean, S. Clay Wilson's panels, like I look at them now and they just jack my brain. I don't know how old I was when I first saw it, but it couldn't have helped. Or maybe it did help. Maybe it gave me way more information than I could ever use, but I have it as a reference point in my brain right now. He was with the guys over at Zap, I think, in San Francisco. I'm going to read the book, but I'm too busy looking at the pictures. I don't know a lot about him, but it is filthy beauty. Oh, my God. Just celebratory debauchery. And he is still around, and he's had a little trouble. I think he took a spill and he's not well. If you go to sclaywilson.com, it'll take you to the sclaywilsontrust.com and you can donate a little money. This guy, it was a great artist, and he made a profound contribution to elevating, you know, gritty, dark, poetic, beautiful art in the world. And, you know, he needs help. He's severely impaired. He had some problems. And you know, when you're an artist, you don't always prepare for the future, and he needs some help. So go to sclaywilson.com or sclaywilsontrust.com and kick in a few shekels for this guy. This guy's he was a warrior. He was a hero of the imagination, and he deserves your help. And I want you to help him because he blew my fucking mind. All right. Okay. And also pick up this book, man. I mean, The Mythology of S. Clay Wilson, Volume 1, Pirates in the Heartland. If you're not familiar with the dude, the guy was a fucking genius. I mean, he was there with Crumb in Spain and that crew in San Francisco, and he was doing his own thing, man. It was all that momentum of the 60s just exploded in satiric debauchery. It's just fucking beautiful. I'm just looking at it, and it's making my brain juiced. It's making me remember the first time I saw it. Like, do you remember the first time you saw, like, sex, you know, in a comic or in a book, and you were like, oh my God. And then the first time you had sex, you're like, I'm sorry. Do you remember? I mean, there's a learning curve to that. First time you see sex, usually it's before you have sex, and you're like, oh my, I'm going to do that myself. And you have some control over that. And then you're like, I think I'm going to apply this knowledge to a real person when I get the opportunity. And then you got a head full of what you're supposed to do, and you go, oh no, why? What happens now? Time to clean up. I was thinking about that, though. I was thinking about my life and about my dick. Is this getting too crass? Is this not, am I riding the cusp of highbrow and lowbrow right now? Am I just rambling? I'm a little beat up because I went running, haven't gotten running. I drank too much coffee and I didn't sleep enough. I got up early. I went to a meeting to get my brain in the right place to survive, And, you know, maybe I'm pushing the envelope. But how can you, did you ever just sit and think, now I'm a man, and I'm sure women, I don't know what the experience is for women, but I can be empathetic, but I just don't know. Like if a guy, the first time a guy has sex, that guy being me, it might not go well, but it's 99.9% chance that it's going to feel good. And that is not something that I think that I hear from a lot of women. I think that, you know, for women, it can be painful, it can be difficult, it can be awful. For a guy, it can be awful, but it's always going to be, you know, you're always going to be like, oh, you know, there's that. There's never a lack of that. And I was just thinking about it. I don't know why I'm thinking about it, because I think I told you about this before, but like my brain seems to want to regress. So like I think I'm on the verge of actually having some genuine self-acceptance and not spinning as much garbage as I usually do, but my brain is panicking because it doesn't know what happens in place of that. So I seem to be regressing and thinking back, not being nostalgic so much, but listening to music that makes me kind of buzz out. And I thought about, did I tell you that already about, you know, almost buying a skull shirt, you know, for safety? Which was something I used to do because I had to protect myself with skulls at one point in time. But then I started going further back. And do you fucking remember the first time you had sex? I mean, really remember the feeling and then just being like, oh my God, I am the universe. I am part of moving forward. Everything is moving through me. All of history is happening right now and my head's about to explode and it's going to be messy. Do you remember like just like the feeling of like, it's happening. Oh, God damn it. Maybe I am just getting old and nostalgic. Maybe this is a midlife meltdown thinking about this kind of stuff. I'm not saying sex is bad now. It's great. Nothing wrong with it. Awesome. But that first time, it's like the first time for any of that first fucking boom. Yeah, I mean, sure, there can be love involved. I mean, that's fine. But I think in the long run, for me, it's not the love I remember. It's the feeling of having it inside of something. Yeah. Oof, boy. Remember the first blowjob? Oh, my goodness. What a night that was. In a car, beside a park, hoping the cops don't show up, just making the rounds, hoping that whatever is happening will continue to happen. And I remember specifically thinking, I think I'm going to need more of this. This is a positive thing about being alive and in the world. Oh my God, man. I feel like it's apple time. It's pumpkin time. I want to be wearing a hat. All right, look, Chris Parnell is here. Let's talk to him, okay? We're going to talk to Chris.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Parnell. Chris Parnell, you're one of those that guys.
Is that a good thing?
That's a great thing.
Yeah?
That's the best thing to be. Hey, there's that guy.
I don't know his name or yeah. Where I've seen him. Or...
But that's him. He's in. Oh, he's funny. He's always funny in these things. Oh, there's that guy again. No, I think that might be the best possible thing to be. Because you can always evolve and change.
It's true.
Surprise everybody with a big thing.
I don't know about that. But
why not?
Well, you know, if it comes along.
So what do you live? You live across the way almost. And what do you... How long you lived out here?
Well, I originally moved out here in 92, and then I went to New York in 98 to do SNL.
So you came back out here when?
2007.
And you like it?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Where'd you come from, man?
Memphis, Tennessee.
Memphis.
Yeah.
Beale Street.
Yeah.
The Peabody Ducks.
That's right. The two things people, and Graceland.
Graceland.
Right, the three things everybody knows about
and
Memphis.
And the horrible hotel. Where someone shot Martin Luther King.
Oh, yeah. Which is now the Civil Rights Museum.
Yeah.
The Lorraine.
The Lorraine Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of life? Were you? Were there animals involved? Or
There were cats.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we had cats growing up. Usually one at a time. But,
yeah. Yeah. Is it an outside area in Memphis, or are you right in the city?
Well, I grew up in a neighborhood called Whitehaven, and
yeah.
Then we moved to a suburb called Germantown when I was about 14.
And how many brothers and sisters you got?
I got one sister who's 2 years younger than me. She's,
yeah.
She and my mom and dad and her family are back there.
So you go back there?
I do. But I haven't been back since it's been a while because I had a son.
You did? Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
And how old is that kid?
He's a little over 11 weeks.
Oh, God. So you're not sleeping. This is gonna...
Not sleeping as much as I'd like.
Uh-huh.
I'm sleeping more than my wife.
This is the first kid?
It is.
That's exciting.
It is very exciting.
Oh, my God. So you're in it. You're like, you're at the front lines of doing a dad thing.
We are.
How old are you?
I'm 47.
Wow.
Yeah, I waited a while.
So did you have thoughts about that? Were you like, ugh?
You know, it was more about just finding somebody that I wanted to be married to.
Right. When did that happen?
We've been together a little over 6 years.
41.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I just recently quit the entire relationship endeavor. I'm done.
Yeah?
Yeah. I've been married twice, engaged once, just got out of a relationship. I'm finished.
Come on.
No, it's over. I'm 50. There's no reason. What's the point?
Companionship.
Ugh.
Love.
Love is it?
Romance.
Those things.
Yeah.
Hey, those only last a week or two with me. Then it just comes, you know, damage control and trouble management. I wish there's no honeymoon phase with me, Chris.
No?
No, it's all very fun for about a week. And then time for couples counseling.
How long were you married?
I was married for three. I was with both of those women 8 years each, married 3.5 years each. And I was engaged for about a little less than a year, and that fell apart. You know, it's not always me, man. I, you know, we don't have to talk about me, but I'm more than willing to.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah,
you're more interesting than I am.
I don't know
sure.
If that's true. I mean,
that's definitely true.
I am fascinated with people that grow up in the South. Memphis is an important part of American history, and you come from it.
I do. That's true.
And you come from generations of Southerners.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah.
Did you talk like that at some point? Did you have to get that out of you?
I did.
Seriously?
Yeah.
You had to consciously.
I worked on it at drama school.
So wait. So what'd your dad do when you were growing up?
He's a voiceover guy.
Your dad's a voiceover guy in Memphis?
He was a disc jockey at a station called WHBQ.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Jack Parnell.
Jack Parnell.
Yeah.
Did you do a Jack Parnell impression?
not consciously. People say I sound like him sometimes, but his voice is even more, you know.
And what, wait, so he was a local radio personality?
Yeah. Yeah. And then now he's been a commercial guy. He does voiceovers.
Down there.
Yeah.
You can just do it from there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, does he do nationals?
Every now and then. But it's, you know, it's mostly local and regional kind of stuff.
Oh, you know one other guy whose dad was a voiceover guy. I know the guy whose father was the voice of Count Chocula or Frankenberry. I can't remember. One of those.
Yeah.
His dad was the voice of one of those.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why I'm sharing that with
no,
you.
No, it's interesting.
It's important stuff.
Bit of trivia.
To know your dad was Count Chocula.
Not everybody can claim that.
Like, did your dad host a music show?
He may have co-hosted like a teen dance show at one time.
Teen dance show.
Yeah, I feel like that might have been in the works, but I don't know if it was on television or if it was like at the fairgrounds or something like
that. The fairgrounds.
Yeah.
So your dad's a voiceover artist and your mom, what'd she do?
She's a housewife.
And did you drive cars fast and drink and stuff like that?
I didn't drink.
High-speed chases?
Not really, no. I mean, I would drive fast sometimes when I was late for work.
Yeah.
I bottomed out this Buick my dad had kind of bought for me to use. And he somehow, I guess he took it in to get it repaired or something, and they saw the scrape marks on the bottom of the, you know.
Boy,
the,
you're a rebel, man.
I was out of control, Mark.
Jesus Christ, bottoming out the old Buick. And your dad said, what have you been doing? In his low voice, what have you been doing with this car?
I was late to my job as a disc jockey at a radio station in Mississippi.
Wait a minute, you were a disc jockey as well?
I was.
So when you go places, we're like, so you're Jack Parnell's kid?
Well, it used to be that, yeah. It used to be that, yeah.
Hey, you're going to be in radio too, huh? That kind of thing?
There wasn't too much pressure for that. They were always really supportive of me doing whatever, but then when they realized I wanted to be an actor, they were
cool?
Oh, yeah.
When did you decide to do that?
When I was 17.
And how did you and how did you pursue it? Did you walk in and go, mother, father? Did you do a show?
Well, it wasn't quite that grand, but yeah. I mean, I've been doing plays at my high school and
which ones?
First one I did was The Wiz.
You did The Wiz.
I did The Wiz.
Were you playing The Wiz?
Well, it was a mostly white production of The Wiz.
That doesn't seem right.
Well, you know,
it's not the way it's supposed to
be.
We
made
Chris.
It work.
It's like it's horribly indicative of the region you're from. You whitened.
Sadly, it might be.
You whitened The Wiz. So you took the one. I think that
nope,
was.
Nope, can't have that one.
It was the most famous sort of like black adaptation of right. of a great story. It got a lot of press for being, you know, kind of groundbreaking.
Sure.
You just whitened it right up. You horrible, horrible Southern person.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I'm a monster.
The white whiz.
I was a munchkin.
Okay. At least, well, you didn't. So you weren't taking the brunt of the horrible racist undertaking.
No, I wasn't.
You were just a bit player.
Exactly.
You're a large munchkin.
You know, we were on these milk crates that had rollers on the bottom of them, and we just kind of rolled around.
Oh, so you're on your knees.
Well, I was on my butt, but like seated, like scooting around, so kind of crab-like.
Yeah. This sounds like a slightly disturbing production of this one.
It was a very experimental production.
It sounds a little rough.
It was terrifying.
Yeah, was everybody... Was everybody on wheels?
Just the munchkins. Just the munchkins.
Weirdly rolling around.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty provocative.
Well, we had these giant sort of costumes, like these umbrella-like things that went down to the floor so you couldn't see our legs.
This was
so
your
like
first...
we're floating.
Uh-huh.
Kind of, yeah.
Floating munchkins.
Yeah.
In a white production of The Wiz. Yeah. Maybe I framed it wrong. Maybe it was far ahead of its time.
Like I said, it was experimental.
That was your first...
It wasn't my first theater experience. That was my first musical.
Okay.
Yeah. I did a couple of plays at my other school, my first school, Southern Baptist Educational Center.
You grew up Southern Baptist?
I did.
What does that mean? That's not the snake one. Now, people get mad at me.
Yeah, no. That's not the snakes. That's more...
That's mainstream. Southern Baptist is like Falwell, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm afraid so.
There was those, and then what's the other ones?
There's Pentecostal. Yeah.
Southern Baptist is sort of like what most people are down there. But then, right, and then there's another one that competes with Southern Baptist.
I don't know. Is it Assembly of God?
Yeah, no, I think it is.
Is that it?
Yeah. Were there battles?
not that I would. Only against the devil, Mark.
Always against the devil.
Yeah.
Devil, I don't know who wins ultimately. But were you religious?
I was, yeah. I was pretty serious.
How about now?
Not now.
Really?
No more.
What made it go away?
Well, I always kind of... when I got a little older, I would, well, like later on in high school, I was kind of questioning, like, you know, this, it just didn't make sense.
The practicality of Jesus?
Well, not Jesus. Jesus makes sense. But, you know, the idea that this is the only way you can believe. If you don't believe in him, right, then you're going to hell and everybody, right, else is wrong,
right,
and all that.
Right. How could everybody be wrong?
Exactly.
It seems like some people don't even know.
Exactly. Exactly.
Boy, why do they have to go down?
I know, it's true.
That fella in the picture from another part of the world has no idea,
right,
that he's going down.
It's true.
Is that what sort of the reasoning?
Well,
was?
that's why they're missionaries, you,
mm-hmm,
know,
right, yeah, to scare them. send someone over there to scare them into believing in Jesus.
Exactly.
And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Sadly, I'd say, with all due respect, it works a lot of the time, I'm afraid.
Yeah. You know? So, were you frightened by ministers as a child? Was there fire and brimstone involved?
There was a genuine fear of hell.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I believed in hell and as a place of eternal torment.
And your parents did that to you?
Well, I mean, they weren't, you know, they weren't like,
right,
taskmasters.
They're
about
just
it.
Sort of like, we, oh, just, by the way.
I grew up going to church, you know, and grew up going to these Baptist schools, and I was a believer. And, you know, I got saved when I was young. And
how does that happen?
Well, you go, it can happen different ways, but typically, you know, you go forward in a church service or a chapel service, if it's at school, and you say you want to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior and ask for forgiveness of your sins, and you invite Jesus into your heart.
Mm-hmm. You and did that?
I did that.
Did you do it in water? Don't they do it in water?
Well, that's baptism. That comes after that. That's after you've gotten saved and you want to join a particular church, you get baptized.
Did you do that?
I did do that, yeah.
In the water?
Yeah.
With many people in robes?
Just one man. It's just one. In the Southern Baptist churches, typically, I guess it's still this way, I haven't been in one in a long time, there's a baptismal back behind sort of the stage.
You know? River.
No river.
That's just more cinematic.
Well, that's if you're in the country. You,
yeah,
know? Yeah.
Maybe you go for the afternoon with a few other people that need a Dunkin'.
Exactly.
Exactly. So you just go out and back in the tub is what you're telling me.
kind of. But in front of everybody.
Oh, yeah? Is it a big moment? Is it an embarrassing moment? Or is it like he's here?
It wasn't embarrassing. It was just, you know.
It's just what you did.
I mean, I was a kid, you know.
So, right. Yeah. How old?
I don't know. Maybe 6, 7, something.
Interesting.
Like that.
Yeah. So do you remember the preacher? You remember the guy?
I do.
Powerful man?
Sweet man.
Oh, yeah?
Sweet man, yeah.
When he got up, did he put on a show? Was he like, hello, you guys?
He wasn't too... That's exactly what he said. Hello, you guys! You clearly spent a lot of time in churches, Mark. Yeah.
So you decide to be an actor, and your faith in Jesus is waffling.
Yes.
So you've rolled around as a munchkin once.
Right.
So a lot of things have happened.
That's kind of my life.
You bottomed out a Buick.
Yep. It was a wild life.
Crazy southern life you had.
Lost, reckless, yeah, youth.
So where do you end up going to study?
I went to a North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. It's now called University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and studied drama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole time, 4 years you did.
Did the 4 years, I got my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. Very important document to have.
It is. Did you frame it? Because that'll get you work anywhere. People are like, whoa, you can do whatever you want to do. Come on inside.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I still bring it to auditions with me. I got my BFA.
from North Carolina.
Yeah.
You feel strong as an actor? What was your defining role in college?
I did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That was McMurphy.
You did McMurphy?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was kind of a big deal, because everybody else in my class, all the other guys in my class, were like vying for the role and thought, you know, they were going to get it. And we had to audition, and I turned out to get it. And that was kind of like a little victory for me, you know, because I was by no means the biggest guy. I was one of the smaller guys in class, you know, and they were all just, you know, thinking it'd be a bigger.
Because I imagine that most people think that Nicholson defined that role, but I think the way Kesey wrote it and the way that the playwright hijacked his novel for the play, he was a big redheaded guy, right?
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, because I remember in the book that it was this massive kind of Irish force of a man.
Exactly.
And Nicholson was actually against type.
Right.
Kesey was very upset about it.
Was he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Furious. He wrote the novel. He did not approve of the movie. He approved of the play, kind of.
Yeah.
So they took the movie from the play, so he didn't sign off on it. And there's sort of a famous story about someone asked him if he had seen the film.
Right.
And he said, if someone came to your door and said, there's a bunch of Hell's Angels raping your daughter. Do you want to go out and watch? Would you go?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It's a little dramatic.
A little bit.
Yeah, but he was, you know, he was a big personality, that fella.
I guess so.
So when you did McMurphy, did you feel like you were really doing it? Really acting?
Eventually. I mean, that's what rehearsal is for. But I think by the time we opened, I was in a pretty good place with it. It was a bit of a stretch.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why? But, had you seen the movie?
I think I'd seen the movie.
It must have been out by then.
I'd seen the movie. But, you know, obviously I wasn't going to try to do it like Jack Nicholson. And that was the thing. That was the reason most of the guys in class didn't get it, is they were kind of doing it like Jack Nicholson a little
right.
bit.
Right. What do you learn in drama school? What did you learn that you still carry with you? Are there things that you, like when you're on stage or in a film or on a television show where you're like, is there still stuff in there that...
You know, the simplest thing that I try to remind myself of is just to listen.
Right.
To really listen and then to really talk to somebody.
Right.
You know.
And not be self-conscious.
Yeah, not just to have these lines in your head in a pre-planned way that you're going to deliver these lines, which for comedy is hard because it's like, oh, I think the funny way to say this is this.
Yeah.
You know, but you want to be in the moment, you know.
But you do have to make choices before, eventually, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. I talk to actors, and all of them have sort of tricks and little things that they know, but it's innately something you either can do or you can't, I think.
Yeah, it's true. Well, you're an actor.
Kind of. You know, yeah. I mean, I'm a stand-up, but I've acted a bit. Yeah. But I do have problems with sort of like, should I move my feet? You know, am I going to just stand here? Am I standing here? I'm just standing here. That kind of stuff.
I know. I struggle with that.
You do?
Sometimes, yeah.
Where you're just sort of like, should I move something?
I know. What do I do with my hands? And don't. Yeah. My tendency is to gesture too much sometimes.
I do too, but I think I do that in real life. I don't know.
Right.
I you know what would be helpful if somebody just filmed us for the day?
Right.
You know, secretly.
I know it would.
Just so you're kind of like, well, I do that naturally.
Yeah.
And you know, look, I don't know what to do with my hands in life either.
I think it would be really upsetting to watch after the fact, you know? It's like, because if somebody shot something of me that I kind of wasn't aware they were shooting with their iPhone or whatever and I watched it. I'd be like, oh, God, that's what I look like? That's what I sound like? That's
why isn't somebody give me some direction?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just like, oh, God.
So So you went back home after college?
Eventually. I mean, I went down to the Alley Theater in Houston. It's like a regional theater down there. They had this apprentice actor program. So I did that for a season.
So that was like your graduate school in a way?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. I mean, it was just something to do.
What was the plan? In your mind?
Well, originally the plan was to go to New York with my buddy Adam and, you know, try to be theater actors in New York.
And like, then, just like Duvall and Dustin Hoffman. You're going to live together, maybe go to the Method place a little bit.
Yeah.
That was the plan.
But after Houston, I was kind of disenchanted with the whole acting theater thing.
What happened there? How did they break your heart in Houston?
Well,
how did they break you?
I was pretty cocky. I mean, I thought I was pretty great. And, and I didn't get sort of invited to stick around and be a part of the larger company, of the main company, even though they technically didn't have one, but they had a pool of actors they used a lot.
In Houston. So you go out there to do this Alley Theater thing in Houston as an apprentice.
Right.
And they don't ask you back in Houston.
Right. Right.
So that was...
That was rough for me. That was rough.
I can imagine. Maybe they already had a Chris Parnell type.
They probably did. They probably did.
I could see how that'd be a bummer. Like, so you're thinking, like, if I can't cut it in Texas.
Well, and there was another guy who was an apprentice with me who, perfectly lovely guy and talented, but I was better than him.
And he got it.
He got it. But he was a better singer than me, so I think that had something to do with it.
Was there ever that moment where you're like, how far can I go doing regional theater?
I don't think I had that.
You just wanted to act.
I wanted to act, and I knew there was this regional theater circuit around the country, and that seemed less intimidating, I think, than New York did.
Yeah.
You know, that seemed reasonable. It's like, I'm not shooting too high.
And you could also practice and do your shit.
Yeah. You know, and be a part of this community and, you know, travel a little bit.
Right. So now you're sadly returning to Memphis from Texas.
I returned to Memphis.
And you sit down with your dad, and he says, son, what?
Nothing. No, I mean, he was happy. They were happy to have me back. I moved back home.
Really? Into the house?
Yeah. But I taught high school for a year. That's what I did.
Really?
Yeah. My old drama teacher,
who
was like a big influence in my life and still a good friend, he said, you know, you want to come back and try teaching for a year? And I was like, geez, sure. I don't know what else I'm going to do. So, yeah, I'll try that.
He sensed that you were wavering.
I think, yeah. I mean, you know, and he...
You got beat up a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah. But I mean, it's like, it's pathetic to say that because I hadn't even done anything. I mean, it's like, so.
Rejection's rejection. You know, like, yeah. He was helping you out in a way.
Yeah.
How is he a big influence in your life?
We had this amazing theater program at my high school, Germantown High School, and an amazing television program as well. And so we did really good stuff. And you know, he basically taught me how to act. I mean, he was the first, he said to me at a certain point, he's like, hey, you know, you can really do this if you want to.
Right.
You know, you're actually good enough to do this for a living.
Uh-huh.
And he encouraged me to pursue it, and I did.
You need that one guy, right?
You do. I mean, I certainly did.
Yeah, especially with something like acting. How the hell are you going to know?
Exactly.
But did he say things like, you see that other guy over there? He's not going anywhere.
I don't know that he quite did that.
No. You, on the other hand, that guy, I don't know what he's doing.
All these other guys, they are shit. But you?
You're going somewhere, kid. Don't let them drag you down. What was the experience in teaching like? Did you have that in you?
It was hard. It was really hard.
Yeah?
I was like 24, 25, so I wasn't ready to be...
You weren't that far out of the woods.
No.
You weren't that far away from being a high school
kid.
Exactly.
And I had to wear a tie and a jacket and be Mr. Parnell and... Oh. Yeah, I wasn't nearly ready to be that much of an adult.
And there was some strutting involved. I mean, you're dealing with high school kids. They have to, you got to deal with that whole ego issue.
Oh, there's going to be troublemakers in any class.
And, was there?
Oh, yeah. And they just made it hell. And because I wasn't mature enough or whatever enough to know how to sort of deal with that.
Right.
Well.
Did you ever snap and just go, look, you think I want to do this?
You think I want to be here?
This is not my choice. Things didn't go well for me in Texas.
I was supposed to be on Broadway. God damn it.
No, none of that.
No, I do remember one time saying that I'm not the villain here. That's something that had happened. It's like, I am not the bad guy. I'm not the villain. And
this is drama class. You guys should be happy to be here.
Yeah, I was not cut out for that. But after the bell rang and I was dealing with like the theater kids and the TV studio kids who were really like focused and dedicated, that was great.
Yeah.
I loved all that.
Oh, right,
the
right,
stuff
right.
that I had done, you
right.
know.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
that was fantastic. But the actual teaching I was not so good at.
When did you become interested in comedy?
Well, we did a play called Greater Tuna my senior year of high school. Me and my buddy Dan McCleary. Mm-hmm. And each person plays about 10 different parts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and all these quick changes and stuff. It's a great little play.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of my first time being, supposing, where I was supposed to be funny on stage,
right.
really. And it worked, and, you know, I got good laughs, so.
That's it.
That was it.
And after that, I was hooked.
Well, you know, honestly, it wasn't until I got to college, because I just wanted to be an actor, and I thought I'd be a dramatic actor, you know? And then at college, the kind of things that I seemed to be excelling at were more the comedic roles. And
But you didn't know you had a knack for it. Because you're very funny. You seem to, you know, you lock in. You've got very deliberate and natural timing. You can go over the top and you'd be weird. And you have all that stuff.
Thank you.
But you're very, not in real life.
Not in real life at all.
You're just like, no, you're just
a your
guy.
Audience is finding out.
No, but I mean, do you find that you're funny? And like, you didn't know you were funny. Or did you know?
You know, I think I always tried to be funny when I was a kid. You
right,
know, I was like
right.
a bit of a class clown, but I don't know that I was ever successful at it.
So you didn't have that weird, desperate need to disrupt and, you know, hijack situations with your, you know, hilarity?
Only somewhat.
Yeah.
Only somewhat. Yeah.
So I imagine the first time you had to play comedy, the context and the fact that you could, you know, kind of repeatedly get laughs in doing a performance must have been like, holy fuck.
Well, it was like, oh, this is what I've been wanting to do all along. I just didn't know it. You
right.
know? It's like, this is where I'm supposed to be.
Is that when you were sort of introduced to your timing, that you knew that you could pull it off? I mean, it is an innate thing. You can't manufacture it.
Yeah, but I also think you can learn a lot. You
yeah.
know? And I think I've learned a lot as I've gone on and gotten older. Yeah.
Like what?
Well, you just watch what other actors do,
yeah.
you know, especially other comedic actors,
right.
and you pick up little things from them, you know.
So what happens? So you hit the wall. Now do you feel like you have failed as a high school teacher, or you were just like, I got to get the hell out of here? How do you get out of your house? You're living with your parents teaching high school in Memphis, Germantown, and you're like, what happens? Was there a crisis of... of soul? Was there a dark night of the soul, Chris?
I guess there was somewhat. I just knew I didn't want to keep teaching. And I said, well, you know, I haven't really given the acting thing a try. So if I'm gonna try to be an actor, I need to actually make some more effort. And that's when I decided to move out to L.A.
Did you have friends here?
I did. I had some friends out of here. L.A. was, I'd never considered L.A., and this is embarrassing.
Well, this is crazy, because, like, why would you with show business?
Well, I know, right? Why would you? Well, because I'd always thought I was going to be a theater actor.
That is so bizarre to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I've talked to a lot of people that have that feeling, and I think it's a romantic idea. You know, like, it's sort of like, I don't know always, I'm not saying it's amazing, that is, like, the hardest path.
It is.
You know,
is.
Like, they're like, even in movies and stuff, you know, there's like 10 guys that are, you know, really kings of it in any given decade.
Right.
But theater, it's like three.
Well, and the amount of work you have to do.
And just the amount of work that there really is to earn a living.
Right. Exactly.
Incredibly limited.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
it's crazy.
Well, so you kind of woke up with the LA thing. You were like, maybe there's. There's opportunity out where show business is.
Yeah, you know, and I had friends out here who
were doing it.
Some, yeah.
Who was? Are they around?
They are. I had gone to school with Dietrich Bader. He had left after sophomore year because he was getting work out here, and he actually was one of the first people that said to me, he said, "You need to go take classes at the Groundlings," which was some of the best advice I ever got, because kind of everything sprang from that. Then
so many people have sprung from the Groundlings. It's very interesting. I was just talking to Dax Shepard.
Oh yeah,
that, you know, and that was like, I knew a little bit about the Groundlings years ago, that it was like the Los Angeles version of
Second City,
and that's where SNL. But you know, it's amazing how there are these very different schools of where funny people come from. You know, there's stand up, there's the Groundlings, there's Second City, and you know, and that's and now UCB.
Right.
But like, they're, you know, kind of tracking the difference between the personalities of stand ups and sketch people. And so what year was that? Did you audition for the Groundlings?
It was 92, February of 92, because that's when I moved out to LA.
And where was your first apartment here?
First apartment was on El Centro, just above Santa Monica. It's like a block east of Vine.
It's weird when you first move out here, because you're like, where am I? How does this city work?
I know. Well, I knew I wanted to be in Hollywood, because that was exciting.
But like, didn't you have that weird feeling of, like, you had friends here, which is fortunate, but it's very easy to feel like, wow, how does this town work?
Oh, no, absolutely.
I'm not completely sure.
I'm still learning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to, like, I'm close to things.
Right.
Yeah, I can drive to a store.
It's nice.
Yeah, you know, but you realize very early on that it's like, well, there's no real center here, but you do try to pick one, don't you?
You do. You have to pick what works for you.
Yeah.
You know, now it's Silver Lake.
Right. All right, so, okay, so you audition for the Groundlings just for the classes.
Yeah.
And you get in.
That first class I was in, a guy named Scott Wainio, who ended up, is still a good friend, and was a writer on SNL.
Uh-huh.
A guy named Mike LaPrete. Those are the two main guys that started out with me. But around, you know, by the time we got into the Sunday show and all that, there was, like, it was on a gas tire, and there were more people, you know. And then just above me was, like, Will Ferrell, Sherry O'Terry, Chris Kattan.
They were around.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So, but you're all young, and you don't know that the guy who's just a little ahead of you is going to be the king of the comedy industry.
I know.
So how many years? That's like a long haul. So once you got in, you have to go through what, 2 or 3 years of classes?
You go through 4 different levels of classes.
Yeah.
And you have to get, you know, like, moved up through each one, and then you get into the Sunday show.
Yeah.
And then you do that for anywhere from like a year to longer if you can. And then,
but some people don't make that.
No, yeah. Most people don't.
What was your strong suit?
Monologues.
Uh-huh.
Monologues, yeah. That's what I fared the best at. I mean, I was good in scenes, but I was best at writing monologues, down lefts, they were called, because that's where we would...
How does that work? So what? I've never been to a Groundling show, so that is an actual part of the show, down left. How does that fit in?
Just somebody comes out in the down left portion of the stage, there's a little
and
area.
It's a character piece?
Yeah, character or multiple characters or...
Really? And you're alone?
Yeah.
How is that set up? It just comes out of nowhere?
The scene goes dark before, and the audience applauds, hopefully.
Yeah.
The band plays,
yeah,
and then the lights come up down
and
left.
And you just do a thing that you've constructed.
Yeah.
Were any of those characters, did they stay with you?
You know, I tried to take some of the Groundlings stuff to SNL, and I mean, I used it in my audition, which was, it was really helpful for that, but I don't know that any of it made it on the air.
What were they?
Well, I had a Southern preacher.
Yeah.
You know, who was kind of, it became clear as he preached more that he was kind of perverse and obsessed with young girls and that kind of thing. And then I had a guy who was a big baseball fan, and he was sitting there with his family at this Atlanta Braves game, and sort of there were all these multiple points of focus, talking to his kid and then the person behind him and all this.
So that's where you first started to get the experience of writing comedy?
It was, yeah. I mean, I fared best. If I was writing a scene, I always did best writing it with somebody else. But, you know, obviously, I could write monologues by myself.
Were you guys sitting around watching Will and those guys?
Well, Will and them got on SNL. I think I was in the main company then, or maybe I was in the Sunday show. But we would, I remember going back to the office in the backstage area between scenes and watching them on their first SNL, because it was so exciting. Nobody from the Groundlings had gotten on SNL in a while. You know, it had been like Phil Hartman, and then I don't know if there's anybody after Phil.
When did you start to realize that that was something you were gunning for? I mean, once you entered the Groundlings, was that on your mind, SNL?
It was only on my mind because they would occasionally come and look at us, and there was a time when I knew, it's the time that Anna Gasteyer ended up getting hired, and they had looked at tape of me, and I didn't get it. I didn't even get the audition or anything. So I thought, oh, that was my SNL shot. Too bad.
But were you doing other auditions? Were you acting at all? Were you working?
Yeah, I was doing like guest star spots in sitcoms and stuff.
Oh, you were, yeah.
Yeah. There was enough going on for me to say, okay, I'm not an idiot for doing this. And I was getting commercials and things like that.
So when did the audition happen? When did it click?
It was the next go-round when they were looking at people, and I happily didn't even know they were looking at us again.
So 92, so what year is it now that you come out
now? Now it's like 97, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah.
So 5 years of guest stars and commercials and going through all four levels, and you've been in the Sunday show for, what, a year or so?
Yeah, and then I got moved into the main show.
So who comes for the audition, and you didn't know they were there?
No, I had no idea they were there.
Who was it, Marcy?
Maybe. I don't
you
know if
still
it was her.
Don't know.
I still don't know. No.
You just, someone said, you got a call, your agent got a call.
After the fact, I got a call from my agent saying they had, again, requested tape, and I had a little more tape to show at that point, and they wanted to fly me to New York.
That's exciting.
It was exciting and terrifying at the same time.
Did you feel ready?
At that moment, no, not at all. Because I had to get my audition together, you know.
And how many characters did you do?
They wanted three characters and three impressions. I ended up doing four characters and two impressions just because I didn't really have any impressions.
Who were your impressions?
Tom Brokaw and this MTV VJ at the time named Jesse.
Yeah.
Which was, it was not a very good impression.
Uh-huh. You didn't feel strong in the impression zone?
I didn't. No, not at all. But the Brokaw was, I somehow just sort of realized we...
Yeah, you do a good Brokaw.
Yeah, I mean, that's all right.
Thanks. Yeah. You're still not great. You don't feel great about your impressions.
It's all right. I feel a lot better about that. I mean, it was like SNL was like impression school in a way, because they just, you know, every week it's like, here, you're going to be this senator. Here's some tape. Yeah. You know, study
that's
this.
That's how it works.
Yeah, kind of. And my first show, I had to be Kenneth Starr.
Yeah.
And it's like, how does Kenneth Starr sound? What does he look like? Because he wasn't. We knew his name, but he wasn't that much of a
Kenneth
media
Starr
presence.
From the guy who lynched Clinton.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I had to be him, and like, how do you do that? And I mean, Daryl Hammond, genius at it, and Jimmy, and so many guys who are
Jimmy Fallon,
yeah, who are genuinely brilliant at it. But it was really, I really had to work on it
because it's tricky because you have to not only do an impression, but you have to tweak the elements of the personality that define that guy.
Yeah, and find what's funny, and
right.
if there's not something there, then you sort of have to make a take on it that is funny. And it's like Will Forte when he did George Bush.
Yeah.
It was so off. It was so different, but it was funny, you
right.
know? For me, the hard thing with impressions was I am kind of a literal person in some ways. So I want to do the impression just as much like that person sounds as I can.
I think Daryl's a little like that.
Yeah, but no, but Daryl knows how to find a hook.
Yeah.
He finds a thing about it
right.
and twists it and tweaks
right.
it. I mean, he's got a great instinct for that. Whereas I have to really think about it.
So, okay, so you fly back for the audition, and what happens? Walk me through the Lorne hoops.
You know what? It was It was great. I mean, they put us up at a nice hotel, and I was there with this actor, Mike McDonald. He was one of the ones actually in the Groundlings with me. And we were both auditioning, and we did our scenes for each other, and deliberately didn't laugh because we'd heard not to expect laughter.
In the hotel room, you did this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And we just drilled them over and over, and that made all the difference. And so you go into the stage, into 8H, and you go up on home base, what it's called, where the host does their monologue, and there's a camera in front of you, and then there's people sort of sitting around in the dark that you don't know who they are. You know, Lorne's probably among them. And then you do your little presentation, you know, and hopefully it goes off well, and mine did. I kind of nailed it.
Did you get laughs?
I did get some laughs, yeah. Not a lot, but I got some laughs.
Yeah.
And then Fred Wolf, who was just leaving as the head writer, like followed me down the hall and was just like, man, that was fantastic and was so encouraging and nice. And I was like, oh, great.
Were you suspect of it, though?
No, not of him. He was really genuine.
He's a nice guy, yeah.
Yeah, he was really genuine. And and then I stuck around for another day or two to meet with some of the head writers and stuff, and then went home and just waited, you know, to find out. You know, it's like this huge thing that could happen in your life or might not happen. So it's like, do you get hopeful about it or are you just trying not to think about it?
And what was the call like?
It was from my agent. I was living in Studio City at the time. I was standing on Ventura. I think she paged me.
A pager,
I had my
yeah.
pager. And I called her on a payphone in front of California Pizza Kitchen. And she, you know, said, you know, they want to hire you. They want you to come up in X number of weeks and all that kind of jazz.
And so you moved to New York.
I moved to New York, yeah. I kept a place here.
Yeah.
I kept a place here and moved up there. And yeah.
And then you met Lorne.
And then I met Lorne, yeah.
In his office.
It was cool. I remember he called me in and he was like, you know, you've got more experience than Jimmy and Horatio, and you know, because I'd done more TV, I guess, you know. And so, you know, we may be relying on you more for that stuff. And I was like, okay, cool, great. Obviously, Jimmy and Horatio were fine. they were very fine with less experience. But he was cool. You know, he was nice.
You seem very practical. You don't seem to have the standard kind of like weird kind of, you know, insecurity and insanity of a comedic, person.
Well, I've never done stand-up. Because it's terrifying to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So I was just approached from wanting to be an actor.
Right.
But I mean, yeah, I'm definitely insecure. I mean, I definitely have some self-loathing and all that stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But
like, it sounds to me like, you know, he looked at you as sort of a grounded person.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, as opposed to like, well, there's a lot of crazy people here.
Right.
That's how I just decoded what he just said. Yes. I don't know what's going to happen with the...
I think there might be something in that.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So you just start, and how quickly were you on camera?
I was on camera my first show in the cold open doing Kenneth Starr. It was a sketch called Oprah 2000. This was in 98, and it was imagining how all the players from the Clinton Lewinsky scandal were getting along 2 years later on
okay.
Oprah. Tim Meadows was Oprah. John Goodman came on as Linda Tripp, and Molly was Monica Lewinsky, and Daryl was Clinton, of course, and I was Kenneth Starr.
And you got laughs?
I might have gotten a little bit of a laugh. I mean, nobody knew who the hell I was,
right,
you know. And,
right.
So
it's a tough one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you just come on and try not to screw up and, you know, look like you belong there and all that.
Now,
kind
who
of
was jazz. On? So they were all in your cast. So who else was in your cast?
Well, it was Will Ferrell, Sherry O'Terry, Chris Kattan, Anna Gasteyer.
It's a big cast.
Tim Meadows.
Jimmy
Fallon, Horatio Sands. Shortly, the next year, it was Rachel Dratch. There was Tracy Morgan.
Tracy, that's who I auditioned with. So that was 94.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What was your audition like?
People are tired of hearing it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I met with Lorne and it was very odd. But, you know, that's the past and now everything has turned around.
It has.
Yeah, I'm doing this in my garage and, you know, I'm talking to you about, you know, your great success.
You got a TV show.
Yeah, I know. I'm not playing
Tour of the country.
I think that everything worked out fine, but it does sort of stand in my mind as sort of, there's some part of me that wants to be like, just have to sit across from Lorne. Like, I want to interview him for, you know, who he is.
Right.
But at some point, I'd like to go, what happened that day? Seriously.
I mean,
what?
I know. I think a lot of people probably feel that way.
I think it'd be an amazing conversation.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. He's a very interesting man.
He is. He's like the
king of late night now. I mean,
he's the king of everything.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, if you really think about it, like his place in modern television, there's nobody more important.
He's up there.
So how long was it before, you know, he gave you the boot?
Well, I got the boot after 3 years. And this is
what the fuck is that about?
Yeah, you know, it was, I never knew the answer to that.
But when did you really start to feel like, all right, things were clicking? When did you do that thing with Sandberg? Was that the second time? That was after you got fired the first time,
That
right?
was after I got fired and came back.
But you were, you know, you were in a lot of bits. You did a lot of impressions.
Yeah, you know, I did okay. You know, yeah. I wasn't like a breakout star or anything.
Did you feel the environment was very competitive?
Yes and no. But, you know, I felt like the writers there liked writing for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was working on my own writing with, you know, other people and would occasionally get some stuff on. And so I felt like, you know, I'm not the head banana here, but, you know, I'm doing okay. I'm a good ensemble player and, you know.
But you knew that. You knew that, like, well, that guy's, he's a big ham and he's going to.
Well, I mean, Jimmy was clearly, you know, kind of breaking out. And obviously Will was amazing and everything as he should have been.
Right.
And Sherry was a genius and Catan had all his characters. And I mean, yeah, you know.
But it's interesting, out of them, and Daryl was still around. But, you know, Daryl was like a lifer over there.
For, I know.
And like people could be great, but it didn't necessarily mean that the breakout was going to stick.
It's true. It's true.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Like, there are people that worked great on stage, but they didn't make the jump, you know, and as big as some other people had. It's like, you couldn't have assumed that Jimmy would end up where he is.
No. I mean, not at all.
It's wild.
I know, it is wild.
Because he tried a couple movies, and, you know.
I know.
And Catan did a couple of big movies.
Right.
But, he, you know, show business is.
Well, Catan's doing the stand-up thing now.
Yeah, that I don't know that that's a good story. you know, stand-up's not so the thing you want to end up on. I just know that from experience. You know, I know he's a great talent, but it's just like show business is kind of, you don't know what the fuck is going to happen, man.
You don't. Well, you got to diversify.
Yeah, you got to figure it out.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, when you got fired, were you surprised that first time? I mean,
I was very surprised. I was pretty devastated. I'd never been fired from any job, and then
how was it handled?
My manager, Jimmy Miller, at the time, called me.
Jimmy, big manager.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Julie Darmody, then Wixon, is now kind of more my lady, but it was such a big call that Jimmy, you know, called and said, "Man, I don't know what to tell you. They're not bringing you back." And it was, I was just parked the car and just sat there. I don't think I cried. I just was like stunned. I was just like.
What was the reason?
No real reason.
Ugh,
no real reason.
The worst.
Yeah.
Norton didn't talk to you?
No. Yeah. But when he hired me back, I went back in the 13th episode of what was my fourth, turned out to be my fourth season.
So you were out for how long?
I was out the first 12 episodes of season four.
So you get cut. And you got to take that hit. You don't know why.
Right.
And why do they ask you back?
Well, you know, I heard from Will Ferrell almost immediately. He said, look, I talked to Lorne because I think he and Catan actually went to bat for me. And I think a number of the writers and people did. There was this big outpouring of support. Like, we don't know what's going on here. And it felt very genuine. It wasn't just like, you know, lip service. And he said, Lorne, you know, it's kind of indicated the door's not completely shut. So I was like, oh, okay. So there was this kind of this emotional roller coaster of I would hear from Jimmy Miller like, well, Lorne's saying he still might bring you back. And
weird.
So, yeah, it was weird. It was hard. And I had already given up my place in New York and I was living back in L.A., but I had all my...
Were you doing movies and stuff by then or not yet? Or were you just... Was SNL it for the most part?
I mean, I was thinking... I was doing more TV stuff and the occasional movie thing.
Yeah.
You know, and commercials, but...
Right.
All my stuff was in New York, and I was living just here, waiting to hear.
Right. But that's like a limbo. It's not even waiting to hear.
It was a terrible. Yeah, it was bad.
It's just you're just waiting for Lorne to go, okay.
Right. Well, and I finally said to Jimmy, I was like, look, man, I can't take this anymore. So I don't want to hear about any maybes anymore. If they want to hire me back, great. I'm happy to go back. Of course I want to go back. But and then finally one day, they brought me back.
And did Lorne talk to you?
He did. He did. And he said, you know, look, I made a mistake, you know.
Really?
He really did.
What did you do?
I was just so happy to be back there. And
did you get choked up? I just got choked up. I've invested a lot in the character of Warren. So like for him to admit he's made a mistake.
I know, it was a big deal. It was a big deal for him. And I appreciated it. You know, obviously it meant a lot.
And would you just say that? Well, I'm glad I'm back. And
yeah, you know,
and I'm happy you to did be make back. A mistake.
Let's talk about that. Yeah. Let's talk about why you fucked up.
You didn't have that conversation.
I didn't, no.
Go a little more into that mistake. I want to know what your thinking was. That would have been amazing. So you're back.
Yeah.
And there's new people.
There's Seth came on and Andy, and with him Makiva and Yorma is writers and filmmakers. And,
yeah.
Yeah, quite a few people. I'm going to forget a lot of people, but...
Now, was Lazy Sunday the first huge thing?
It was, yeah. That was the first big digital short. It wasn't the first one, but I think it was the second one.
And Andy just was like, you know, they were doing their own thing in that closet they were working at, and then he sort of said, well, you want to be part of this thing?
Yeah, I mean, they'd been making, you know, videos and little series part of the Lonely Island.
Yeah.
You know, and so they already had this amazing skill set to make these things.
Yeah.
And they had seen me do I'd done some raps on Weekend Update, and so they said, hey, we liked what you did. Would you want to do one of these with us? And I was like, of course, absolutely. Yeah.
And that was it.
That was it, yeah. But, you know, you just make this goofy thing.
You're not thinking that, right,
yeah,
right. And it just gets viral. And you did a few of them with him, right?
Yeah, I did a few. We did. It was one with Natalie Portman.
That one's hilarious. That's crazy.
Yeah. She's hardcore. Yeah. She's an actor, you know. She committed.
Yeah.
You know.
That's what you guys do, you actors.
We try.
So now, like, in that, you know, upon returning, you know, your profile was higher.
I don't know that it was higher. I mean, you mean like as in the entertainment business or just on the show? Or
on the show and both, in a way.
Well, I don't know that it was high. I mean, I felt like it was kind of parallel. It was like it was gone down here kind of back to maybe where I was before.
Right, and then what ultimately happened?
It took a while to get my confidence back, in a way. But shortly thereafter, they gave me the President Bush impression.
Yeah.
And I did that for a year, and that led to like an extension of my contract and a raise. And
you took
stuff.
It over from who?
Will had
right,
done it.
Right.
And then it was crazily, I mean, it's one of the few things Daryl could not do. He just couldn't get Will's impression out of his head, I guess he said. And it was the only thing. I mean, it's just like he's the master, but he didn't have a bush.
Yeah. Yeah. And now tell me a little bit about this developing the ability to do impressions, that in terms of when you brought up that it was sort of like impression school, that, you know, how long did it take and who helped you sort of figure out how to put those things together?
I mean, you're kind of on your own.
Really?
I mean, yeah. We had there's a research department who gets this tape for you usually, or I mean, now I'm sure it's just a file that you download, but, yeah, they give this to you and you might get the script or whatever and you look at it and, you just, you know, try to get the voice and
you're just sitting in a room doing
it over and over and, trying to find something special or funny about it.
Wow.
You know? And,
yeah. Who do you think you did best?
Well, I think I did Brokaw best, and then I did Joe Lieberman pretty well. Yeah. Crazily, he was just in my wheelhouse, his voice.
And, yeah, so. Yeah. And what were your favorite characters that you did? Most fun?
I did a character with Jimmy. We were the Bloater Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
These very insecure guys who are always trying to pick up ladies and just failing at it. And then Catan and I did the DeMarco brothers, who were always auditioning to be dancers for whoever, like, the musical guest was. We'd be auditioning to be their backup dancers.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. And I had this character, Merv the Perv, that I liked.
And how did your stint there end the second time?
Well, the second time, it was after 8 seasons, and I was, you know, I could kind of go either way, and they gave me the opportunity to say, you know, do you want to come back? And I was like, well, you know, it's a good paycheck, and I, you know, I don't hate it. It's a cool gig, so, you know, I'm not going to walk away from this. If you want to let me go, you can, and they did, and, you know, but it was me and Horatio and Dratch at the same time, and there were budget cuts, and so it wasn't as big of a hit, not nearly as big of a hit, and I was kind of ready to go. I felt like I'd done my time, you know.
And then you came back out here.
Then I came back out here, yeah. I stayed in New York for about another year because I loved it and had a great place in Soho and wanted to stay there, but the work was here, and I was missing out on work.
And that's like after that run at SNL, that's when, you know, because you've done a lot of fucking movies.
Yeah, I pop up every now and then.
And, you know, so that really your career, you know, outside of SNL was pretty healthy. I mean, you did,
yeah.
Yeah. And when you got 30 Rock, how did that casting happen?
You know, they just called me and they said, you know, we got this character that.
Who called you? Tina? Did you work with Tina?
Yeah. Tina was there. Yeah. Tina and Amy Poehler.
Yeah.
Oh, Molly Shannon, Colin Quinn. Yeah. I mean, just these, all these people. I'm forgetting.
Guys, like, those some golden days there.
I know. Well, I sort of spanned like.
Three casts?
Yeah. Two at least, maybe three. Yeah. It was a pretty great time to be there. But yeah, I think it was my agent saying, you know, Tina and Robert Carlock have, you know, would love for you to play this part in this episode of 30 Rock. And I was like, yeah, of course, absolutely. So I did it. And then it became, you know, a recurring thing. And I think they wrote it with me in mind based on kind of knowing my stuff at SNL.
It's a funny character.
Thanks. It was, I feel very fortunate to have gotten to play Mr. Leo Spaceman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Leo Spaceman.
And what are you working on now?
Well, I'm doing a few animated things. I do the show Archer.
Yeah, with
Judy Greer
and
John Benjamin, Aisha Tyler.
Aisha Tyler.
Amber Nash, Lucky Yates.
That's been going on a while.
Yeah, I think we're about to start recording season 6.
And so you're doing the animated stuff now. You seem to show up in the SNL movies. You're in there.
Well, you know, they brought me back to do a little bit in Anchorman 2, which is great.
Yeah.
And then I do this show called Rick and Morty on Cartoon Network, another animated thing that's really also good. I mean, two really well-written shows.
I don't know how you guys deal with the heartbreak of it. The rejection of being an actor is, you know, you just got to integrate it into your life and somehow frame this, you know, doesn't necessarily have anything to do with you.
I mean, I've been on enough sitcoms that haven't gotten picked up or been canceled or whatever,
right.
That it's, you know.
Well, congratulations on the child.
Thank you.
You seem like a well-adjusted person.
So maybe. Medication helps.
Oh, yeah? What are you on?
Prozac, Wellbutrin, Buspirone.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Were you depressive?
Yeah, mildly, and it's a little obsessive, and anxiety, that stuff.
I have anxiety.
Yeah.
It helps?
Oh, yeah, the stuff helps, yeah.
Well, before you were on it, what'd your anxiety do to you?
Well, you know, I wasn't on anything when I was on SNL, and I sometimes wonder if I would have fared even better, you know?
Had you been leveled?
Yeah.
Yeah?
But it also might have taken something away, I don't know. But
you got OCD issues?
Only mild tendencies, not like serious. But
the anxiety's the thing?
The anxiety is there, yeah.
How did it manifest itself?
Well, it really happened when my now wife agreed to be my girlfriend. I had a panic attack.
Really?
Yeah.
Like couldn't breathe kind of thing?
Well, I could breathe, but it was just like my heart was like beating a million miles per hour. I'd never had one. And I was like, what is going on? And it was like this idea of like, okay, here's this woman that I think I actually can have a future with her. And like, oh, this is a real adult relationship and holy shit. You know? So, I went to see a psychiatrist and got on some stuff. Pretty soon.
Like
the first
sign this thing.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing, it turns out once I started on the Prozac, and I mean, I tried other things and came back to that, but it was like, oh my God, this is how life can be, you know? Like it was
really?
Like,
so you noticed a fundamental change in your personality around that stuff.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It was a relief.
It was a relief.
So you had that weird anxiety always, you just didn't know it.
Yeah, until... I think so, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's good, man.
I know, it's great.
Well, I'm glad you got that under wraps.
Me too.
Right. Good talking to you, man.
Good talking to you.
That's it. That's our show. See, it got interesting there at the end. Now you kind of understand the tone of things. You know what I'm saying? Chris Parnell, another SNL guy. Good Lauren story. Am I circling? Am I getting closer? I got to call Lauren's office. That's our show. What else? Did I do everything? Is everything done? Is there business that needs to be done? Go to WTFpod.com for all that. Get a gift. Get some merch. Leave a comment through Facebook. Get some justcoffee.coop. I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know. I wish I was the checker demon. Yeah. Anyways, people, quick cat check-in. Monkey seems fine. His UTI, I think, is better. He seems fine. Fonda seems to be drooling a lot. I don't know what that is. She's eating. She's, like, hanging out. She's got energy, but sometimes there's just bubbles coming out of her mouth. Is that... Please tell me that's not horrible. I just, like, there's just a little drool. I have not seen Deaf Black Cat. I think he's just eating somewhere else. I'll let you know. I'll keep you in the loop, okay? All right? I'm about to pass out. Oh, my God. I got to get back to where the trees are changing. And I can remember my life. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.